This episode is proudly supported by LMT, the hospitality industry's preferred source for tabletop and more. Learn more at lmtprovisions.com.
Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. So today's guests are a farmer and a chef, brought together through their work at River Park, one of Tom Colicchio's restaurants on the East River in Manhattan. I've got River Park executive chef Andrew Smith and farm manager Jonathan Sumner in studio. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So this episode came about because I was invited to a farm dinner at River Park. And when I got there, I was really blown away by the scale of the farm. All this time, I've been covering agriculture in New York, and I had no idea it was there. Part of it is I think it's just so far east that if you never go over there, you don't kind of stumble upon it. Is that a reaction you get a lot? Like, do people see it and are they kind of amazed by the farm?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the River Park farm has been one of the best kept secrets in Manhattan for the last 8+ years.
Yeah. I wanted to say that it was the biggest outdoor farm in Manhattan, but I don't know if I could say that with total confidence.
I think we can say that it's definitely one of the biggest, if not the biggest.
Yeah.
In Manhattan, it is.
It's got to be, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Perfect. So what's the origin story behind the farm? I guess I want to talk more about the design, and Jonathan, obviously, I think you should speak to that. But Andrew, you've been at the restaurant since it opened, and I understand the farm came not long after. So why, like, how did that come about? Whose idea was it to build a farm?
So the farm actually came about because where we were was kind of newly developed land, and this was back in 2008-ish.
Okay.
And so we are on the campus of the Alexandria Center. And so they had built their first tower, and but the second tower had not been built. And then the economy crashed. Mm. And so they put the site into the stalled construction site program. And then we came on property in 2010, and it was just this big open plot of land with a direct view of the Empire State Building. And the idea got shopped around of, well, you guys aren't doing anything with it right now. Can we put vegetables on it for the restaurant? And for some odd reason, they were like, oh, that's a great idea. We'll partner with you on it. Mm. And so that's kind of how it came about. And then there was a lot of different collaboration with, like, the the Green Market folks and some other people and a lot of consultants.
Great. And I mean, the one of the most striking things about the farm is that it is built entirely in milk crates. Was it built that way from the beginning?
Yes. Yeah. The reason it's built that way is because it was on a stalled construction site and it had to move.
Right.
So they were like, all right, so how do we put in a farm and when we get an anchor tenant, be able to move it?
Right.
And so that's where the idea of milk crates have come in. And it's actually the farm itself has moved twice now. Actually, when Superstorm Sandy came through, we picked up the whole thing and brought it inside so we didn't lose our farm.
Oh my God. Wait, where inside?
So we have a couple of places on the campus that we brought it into our private dining rooms, and we also brought it into our fast casual Little River.
That's incredible. Oh my gosh. And then you had to put it all back after.
Then we put it all back after, yes.
Wow. So Jonathan, can you talk a little bit about that design? So, you know, it's hard to picture, first of all, I think, if someone's never seen it. So the milk crates are all sort of like in clusters. Can you talk a little bit about how that works, and how you actually grow in that system?
Absolutely. So it's 6,400 milk crates total.
Okay.
They're double stacked. So in production, it's 3,200. So that top layer is lined with landscape fabric. We fill it with different types of soil, compost, to get the mix that we want. And then for irrigation, we run irrigation along the perimeter of the farm and then branch off of that onto each of the beds. So we have them all set up into beds with a central walkway. And then it's all, you know, as far as how we grow out of it, it's all about sunlight, figuring out which parts of the farm get the best sunlight. When you were there, I'm sure you noticed that most of the farm was on the north side of a large building.
Mm-hmm.
So managing the sunlight's tricky, and there's all sorts of different things that we do to try and work around that. And the milk crates actually help out a lot in that way because it's useful for me to, even though the farm space is stationary now, it's nice for me to be able to move the individual crates and plots around.
Mm. So you can literally just pick them up and move them when something isn't getting enough light or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I can start things in the best sunlight and then, you know, early in the spring and then move them to a less sunny spot on the farm when it's time for my tomatoes to go in and they want that extra sunlight.
Right.
And then also with crop rotation, because I have such spotty sunlight, I can't rotate my crops the way I would normally want to. So we rotate the crates instead. Which is a bunch of added labor, but it's a, you know, it's a solution to a problem. So we're happy to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any big disadvantages to growing in the crates as opposed to just in the ground and soil?
There's a few. So obviously there's the depth. I'm just working with a set depth. So for root vegetables, things like carrots, you know, I'm specifically growing to a pretty set
right.
petite size. And then, you know, I do different things to try and create as large of root balls as possible within that space. For, you know, larger things, corn, sorghum, tomatoes, stuff like that. Actually, when I plant my tomatoes, I have them coiled up under the soil so that they can expand and utilize that space as good as possible to try and, you know, deal with the fact that their roots can only exist within this confined space.
Right.
And then that means, you know, each crate is its own little biosphere, right? So, you know, I'm inoculating each crate with different types of fungus and bacteria, but the plants don't share, you know, the soil food web. That's something that I'm having to monitor in each and every little crate. So I'm farming out of 3,200 individual plots of land.
Yeah. I mean, and I wonder if, like, if you ever had, like, a disease, like a plant disease, it might actually be a benefit, right? Like, maybe it wouldn't...
It definitely could be. Yeah. It definitely could be. Yeah.
Huh. So we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with more with Jonathan and Andrew and another surprise guest.
Thank you.
This episode is proudly supported by LMT, the hospitality industry's preferred partner for sourcing tabletop supplies. From their New York City headquarters, LMT provides expertise and uniquely curated products for restaurants and hotels nationwide. Whether it's dinnerware, glassware, and cutlery, to small wares and equipment, LMT's approach to tasteful design and product knowledge is simply unmatched. Learn more at lmtprovisions.com and listen to founder Morgan Tucker on episode 4 of Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. This is Lisa Held. I'm in studio with Jonathan Sumner and Andrew Smith from River Park. And over the break, we were joined by Zach Pickens, who runs Farm Tournant upstate. Zach, are you there?
I am. How you doing?
Good. So glad that you were able to join. So your connection was you ran River Park's farm before Jonathan, correct?
Yeah, I was a founding farm manager in 2011, and I was there for five growing seasons.
Great.
And and then moved up here and started a slightly larger farm.
How big is it?
We're farming on 3 acres now in Montgomery, New York, on land that we lease from Windfall Farms, which a lot of your listeners will know from the Union Square Green Market.
Great. And tell us a little bit about what you're growing up there.
We're growing, it's a lot of what we're growing is a continuation of what we were doing at River Park and the conversations we had years ago about what would be smart crops to be growing in collaboration and, kind of things that we always wanted to do but didn't have enough space for. So we've got like a really good crop of potatoes this year, and it's a specific variety called Adirondack Red. That actually I'm growing specifically for Andrew for River Park. Growing squash on a larger scale and harvesting a lot of squash blossoms, and we grow a lot of salad greens and tomatoes, and it's a pretty diverse crop list, but it really is a continuation of the work that we were doing at River Park, just on a larger scale.
Right. So you guys have this little ecosystem. It's like you've got the farm in the city, right at the restaurant. Then you've got Zach upstate growing what you can't grow. Can you talk a little bit about how you all work together in terms of deciding what to grow and what will be on the menu?
It's a very collaborative effort. It's a lot of conversations. It's a lot of flipping through seed catalogs and going, it's when we get into planting season, which is usually around January, it's just conversations. Okay, what worked well last year? What didn't work so well? And what are some things we want to play around with? So, each one of us bring different kind of passion projects to the table over the course of the season. So we'll see things and it's like, oh, I want to try that. Or, oh, can I get that? Like Zach alluded to with the Adirondack Red potatoes, something that I picked up on my day off at a farmer's market, and I was like, these are great. Mm. And I was like, I want those for my Thanksgiving. We do a big Thanksgiving every year. And I was like, Zach, I want you to grow these so I have them for Thanksgiving. And yeah, that's specifically what they're for. So, as a chef, I'm very, very privileged in that way that I can sit there and have a conversation with somebody that I've known for years and say, hey, can you grow that for me? And it'll be like, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, day to day, is it like, Jonathan, are you coming to Andrew and saying like, oh, hey, this is ready to be harvested, like you need to put this on the menu tomorrow? Like, I mean, you're right there. So you kind of have that immediate access.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always an ongoing conversation daily. And so I try to give him a little more heads up than that.
Not like tomorrow.
everything's to a plan.
Yeah.
So we have an expectation of, when things are going to ripen up, how long they're going to take. It obviously doesn't always work to plan. So sometimes I'll, say all of this is ready right now. It's perfect. I have to harvest it all. And then he has to find creative ways to either put it up and store it somehow or use it fresh. and get rid of it however you can.
Right. And so it's kind of a, we were talking about this a little before the break, but I think it's a really interesting thing that Jonathan, you were a farmer in a rural setting, and then you came in and started running River Park Farm, and then Zach, you were running River Park Farm, and now you're upstate doing the rural farm thing. Is it like, I guess, like both of you, like, do your skills translate to both? Like, did you have to learn a lot of new things, or like, what was that transition like?
Zach, you want to take that?
Yeah, it was pretty wild because I grew up in Ohio, you know, like surrounded by corn, and mm-hmm. then I didn't actually start farming until I moved to Brooklyn. Doesn't make any sense at all. But you know, so yeah, I really like, I learned to farm in an urban environment because that's what I was excited about, was like figuring out how to solve, you know, this problem that needed a creative solution, right? And then, you know, farming in the country, not that it's, you know, there's always something to learn, or, you know, in a rural environment, there's always something to learn, something to do better and different. But like, there's a lot of people that already done it, you know, but
right.
I had to be reminded what pests were and what weeds are and stuff like that, you know, like managing weeds and managing pests that we don't have in the city. And, you know, so there was a pretty steep learning curve, but I had a mentorship with Morse Pitts, the farmer here at Windfall in 2015, that really allowed me to like learn by doing and fail, you know, fail, but not in a way that actually affected our business or anything. So I learned a lot that year and had to get readjusted to, you know, farming in the ground. And, you know, I heard Jonathan talking about the soil, you know, soil science in the containers a little bit. Like, you know, I had to relearn how to farm in the soil.
Right.
You know, how to grow food in the soil. And it's totally different in a milk crate in engineered medium than it is in a healthy, alive soil.
Oh, what's the medium that you use in the milk crates?
Well, so we start with, it's about 50% of like a sterile mix, peat based. And then it's the rest of it's compost. So it's loose, holds a lot of water. But we introduce all of the life to the crates through compost and different amendments.
Right. So that was, I imagine, a learning process for you. So did Zach teach you sort of that system, or how was that transition for you?
Yeah, Zach, I mean, has obviously, for the River Park Farm is such a unique growing environment, and milk crate farming is such a unique thing that a lot of the knowledge that I came with didn't necessarily apply very well.
Mm-hmm.
And really there's, you know, it's such a blessing to have somebody who's actually done that before, because traditional farming knowledge just doesn't really apply as much. So, to be able to know and be able to consult, someone with, you know, the only person with experience doing what I'm doing, is super helpful. So he's helped in a lot of different ways, but, you know, with the soil, it's just trying to find something that's going to be super productive, and be able to manage the water well, because when you're farming out of milk crates, if you overwater, it can leach all your nutrients out of the soil.
Mm.
But they also are porous on all sides, so they can dry out really quick. So really dialing in the texture of the soil is one of the more important parts. And that's something that I've been working on and, getting it down pretty good.
Right. Have any of you seen anyone else farming in milk crates this way? I've never seen it before.
I know of one other. There's a milk crate farm in Fenway Park in Boston.
Cool.
Have
you been there?
I have not.
You guys should take a field trip and go visit.
Yeah,
it's a nonprofit, or it's an organization up in Boston that runs that farm, and one on top of a roof of a hospital as well that is farming in milk crates. Yeah.
Cool.
Other than that, no, I don't know of anybody else really doing it at the scale of River Park.
Right. And Zach, you brought up pests. I'm curious, Jonathan or Zach, in the city, do you get pests on the farm that you have to deal with?
You get all of the same insect pests.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I was hoping when I took the job that maybe that you know, I wouldn't have to deal with as many of the insect pests. And then quickly realized that what I was doing was creating the only habitat within a pretty large space for all of those insects.
Right.
yeah. And so, and there's not a whole lot of natural habitat for beneficial insects. So that's something that we introduce regularly. And then also try to construct habitat that they might enjoy sticking around in.
Right.
But yeah, it's all the same bugs.
Huh. Interesting. The same bugs everywhere.
No deer, groundhogs, though.
No deer.
No deer.
No deer, no groundhogs.
Right. Not many squirrels or either. Yeah.
Yeah. So between River Park Farm and Farm Tournant, Andrew, how much of the restaurant's produce are you able to get from them? And like, how much do you need to add?
Well, it varies greatly with the time of year, right. Obviously. The things that, I mean, we have a very large organization, so it's really hard to pinpoint on which, what is the percentage. But the thing is, we try to focus in on specific things. So we're going to get specific things from Zach. We're going to get specific things from Jonathan. So like all of our lettuce mix is coming from Zach. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of pretty much all of our herbs are coming from Jonathan.
Right.
So it's specific things that we get from them. And then we have other companies and farms and things like that that we use to kind of plug in those holes. So it's everybody plays their part.
Right. And does this sort of farm adjacent ethos, is it present on the rest of the menu? Like, are you buying local grains, local meat?
Yeah, as much as possible.
Yeah.
As much as possible. You know, Tom's very committed to, you know, natural meats, antibiotic, hormone frees. We try to engage as many local people as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's as we identify products, you know, it's like, oh, somebody came to me a couple of weeks ago with rice that's being grown in Jersey. And I was like, wow, that's pretty
cool.
Wow,
that's cool.
You know, and so we were like, all right, well, what can we do with that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just as these products come along that we're going to introduce them into what it is we do. I mean, the menu is very much centered around the produce. The produce, you know, I always like to say that I work kind of counter to most chefs. Most chefs start off with a duck dish. I don't start off with a duck dish. I start off with a carrot dish.
Mm.
And then I work my way backwards. And I say, okay, here's what we're going to, this is what we know is going to be coming in at this time of year. So what are we going to be doing with our eggplants? What are we going to be doing with our fennel? What are we going to be doing with this herb, that herb? And then we build the dishes around that.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Is there a dish you can think of that, I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but that like kind of showcased something produced from River Park Farm and something from Farm Tournant?
There is actually one very specifically that I have on right now. It's a red sucrine salad. So it's basically a wedge salad. But Zach is setting aside red sucrines for me. And then our bush beans have just started to come in. So we have dragon tongues and amethysts, and those are all coming in right now. And then we have all these wonderful herbs, you know, the chocolate mint, the emerald gold mint, the nasturtium, the basils. I always say basils as in plural because there's how many varietals?
It's seven on the farm this year.
Seven varietals, and each one brings a different flavor profile. So we're taking all of those things and just very simply dressing it with a little bit of olive oil and lemon juice, and then making a yogurt and buttermilk dressing with dried herbs from the farm, fresh herbs from the farm, and a little bit of poppy seeds that's drizzled over the top and a crouton. And, you know, I kind of take the stance of my job is not to mess up their hard work.
Right. That's amazing. And that's a lot of varieties of basil. And it reminded me, I didn't actually ask you, Jonathan, like how many different things are you growing at River Park Farm?
Throughout the season, it's roughly 100 varieties of probably 30 or 40 types, fruits, vegetables, herbs, flowers.
Right.
So pretty big mix.
Yeah. And you had corn there too, right? Which was surprising when I saw it because it's just so much bigger than ever. You know, like you don't expect a crop like that in the crates.
Yeah. So, growing the corn for multi-purpose crop for me. So all the corn is laid out, kind of along the fence line. So where there's a large drop off and we're pretty exposed to the water. And there's on that side of the farm, there aren't any large buildings nearby. So my biggest obstacle on the farm, on River Park Farm, is the wind. Mm. It's very exposed and kind of almost operates like a wind tunnel sometimes. So creating barriers, to protect other crops is something that's really important for me. So I really focus on trellising a lot of items, to create wind breaks, but along that fence line, I was growing corn mostly as a wind block. But it's also something I think, it's all a variety specific for popping.
Mm, cool.
And I love the narrative behind popcorn, corn obviously being one of the more subsidized crops.
Right.
You know, when you pour popcorn out of a jar into your pan, there's no reason for you to think that any two of those kernels are from the same plant, the same farm, you know, the same region of any state. And so when you have an ear of popping corn and it's dried out and you just rub those kernels off into the pan, you know, just knowing that that all came from the same place.
Yeah.
It's a really cool way to highlight the narrative of local food. And that's one of those things. Chef was talking earlier, about how, you know, we all have our own ideas and bring different experiments to the table. So, you know, popcorn, you know, to my knowledge, didn't have much of a place in a fine dining atmosphere. But Chef jumped right in and has popcorn on a pork belly dish right now, and we're just waiting for mine to ripen up. So it's cool. We all push each other in different ways to do different things.
Yeah, that's really cool. Zach, I want to ask you a little bit about setting up your farm. I talk to a lot of farmers that are getting started upstate on, you know, small with a few acres, trying to do, you know, organic farming and make it work economically. And I know it can be really hard. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you, getting the farm up and running from an economic perspective?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, like the foundation of our business is relationships with chefs. And these are relationships that I have with Crafted Hospitality. That's the majority of our business. And it's also relationships with other chefs in the city that I've known, you know, from living there for years. And really there's so much insecurity in farming that I wanted to take the economic side out as much as possible, you know, like I really want to try to I want to build these relationships so that it's a better product for everybody involved, but also so that we have kind of our business baked in a little bit, you know? So that was the goal going in, is let's try to set things up as much as possible at the beginning of the season so that we're not sitting there holding, you know, 15,000 pounds of lettuce that we can't sell or something like that, you know?
Right.
And, so that was a big first step for us, is thinking about our businesses, standing orders and setting things up well in advance. And that allows me in a lot of ways to plant things differently. I try not to overplant anything because I know what to expect when it comes to harvest time in terms of what we can sell and what we can't.
Right.
So that we can be a lot more efficient in that way. And then, you know, starting the farm, we were really fortunate to, I went through, Grow NYC's, a farm roots training program.
Right.
And it's a business planning, class for young farmers. And we did that, my wife and I did that in 2015. And then that's how we formally got connected with Morse. And I did a mentorship with Morse in 2015, and then he offered land to us to start our business, because he's interested in getting more young farmers, you know, up and running, and doing so in a way that again can kind of reduce the economic risk. So I was able to borrow his equipment for the first couple of years. And, you know, I was using land that was already set up and had infrastructure, and I didn't have to like build a walk-in cooler, and I didn't have to drill a well and everything like that. So that was a tremendous like leg up. Yeah. I mean, it's really scary. I mean, it, like I said, it, you know, there's enough, you know, insecurity in farming.
Yeah.
The fact that we kind of scratched those off the list, we're just really, we're really, really fortunate in that way.
Right. Do you meet other farmers in the Hudson Valley that have relationships like the one you have with River Park, where like they're growing almost exclusively for one restaurant group? Or do you think that's pretty rare?
It's definitely being done. I don't know of anybody else like in the New York City area that's doing it. I mean, other than, you know, Stone Barns growing for Blue Hill.
Right.
But I know Prosser Farm out in Washington is growing a lot of food for the Douglas restaurants out there, in Seattle. And, you know, there's a few others around the country for sure. But, yeah, I'm not familiar with anybody else doing it at the kind of the way that we are here in the New York City area.
Right. That makes sense. So what do you guys all do in the winter?
Sleep.
Well, I still have a restaurant to run.
Well, that's it. Where do you get your produce?
But the things that we do is during the season when Jonathan goes, oh, I have a whole lot of this, is we do a lot of preserving.
I was going to ask you that. That's great.
So that's one of the things about having these relationships, that it's forced me as a chef to be more creative and to think about things differently. So when we're going in, and actually the way that a lot of this got started was one of the first years we had a huge basil crop. It was just, I have no idea how much it was. And it was just like, here, we're clear cutting the farm. You have this to do with. And I was like, oh, okay.
you can't just serve dishes with basil.
Correct.
Like, yeah.
So we had an old proofing box kicking around in the kitchen that we never really used, and just turned it on and didn't put any water in it. And we started loading in sheet trays of herbs and started to dry them. So, and then we end up with all of these different powders and dried herbs. So it has kind of allowed me the opportunity to kind of take some of these flavors from the summer and move them into the colder months. So I can take like the basils, for example. We get all these different varietals in it, and like there's blue spice basil, opal basil, Thai basil, and they all have these very unique flavors. And when you put them together in this mix, it's just like a flavor bomb. And so we'll take that. And I have a pesto that I make with butternut squash, where we take a traditional pesto, kind of flip it on its head, bake out the squash with a holy heck load of the dried basils on it, and then pumpkin seeds, the basils, more of the dried basils, chunk Parmesan, a little bit of olive oil, and we make a pumpkin basil pesto out of it. And then that gets tossed with a zucca pasta. And then we also have a microgreens program that we do indoors. And so, you know, they're downstairs growing different things.
Like hydroponic?
It's in soil and trays under lights.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
So we can get, like, I can have little micro basils and things like that to finish and garnish the dish with. But it lends to a very unique flavor profile that, you know, you don't see anywhere else. So we do that. We do like hot sauces, pickling, different things like that. And it's, you can take these different things that you were in the summer and interpret the cold weather produce in different ways. You know, I mean, we're still getting certain amounts of cellar vegetables and things like that. I mean, obviously, as the winter wears on, some of that gets depleted down.
Right.
But, I mean, that is the way that we really try to bring all the stuff together.
Right. And what about the River Park Farm itself? Like, do you leave the crates there, or do you have to put them inside, or?
Yeah, I leave the crates out all winter. So, you know, the cold winter or the cold season start with lots of cleanup, mm-hmm. You know, already starting to prep the crates for the next season. You know, if I have any cover crops growing, obviously I'll let those go, but then I'll start to turn them in at a certain point. So the farm pretty much stays stationary, and I don't mess with it too much, aside from cleaning it all up and getting it ready for the next season. But for me in the winter months, first, that's the only time of year I take some time off.
A vacation.
So that's nice. But there's so much planning that goes into all of this.
Yeah.
You know, from coordinating with Zach and Chef to figure out who's going to grow what and when we want it, you know, and then we're selecting varieties, and then obviously pretty comprehensive plan for mapping it out and when to plant what and successions of each thing. So there's plenty of work to do in the winter for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And Zach, I imagine you're doing lots of planning in the winter as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was something that really I got in the habit of doing at River Park, because it was such a valuable space that we wanted to maximize as much as possible, that it really was in my interest to like make sure I had it planned out well in advance, and doing really tight crop rotations and succession planning and everything. So that was a good thing for starting our farm up here now, because I was already used to, you know, getting that planning done and trying to be really, you know, maximizing the utility of the space. We also, in addition, you know, being kind of outside of the city, we have more space that we could do off-season growing. So we have a high tunnel up now, a 30 by 96 foot high tunnel, and we're about to add a second one. So, you know, we have the ability up here to be producing through the winter now as well.
Right. What can you grow in the high tunnels in the winter?
Last year we just planted the whole thing with mosh, just a salad green that I really particularly love and is really, really cold hardy. And
that's like what people can't get in the winter and here. I mean, greens, right? Yeah. Like that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was our first year at the high tunnel, and I decided to have a kind of a hands-off year where I'm going to put a salad green in there that will not die. You know, like it is very, very cold hardy, and it's not very hands-on. So that was a good first step into doing winter production.
Right. That's great. So we have to wrap up. One thing I wanted to ask, can people visit the farm? Is that possible?
Yes. So, people are welcome to visit River Park Farm. It's not open to the public. You can approach it. But it, you know, if any time that I'm there, or, if anybody wants to, schedule a tour, they can reach out to me. It's jonathan.sumner@riverparknyc.com. And I'm happy to give tours. Also, you know, guests that come and eat at the restaurant, are also able to get tours. So yeah.
Great. Yeah,
all the dining room managers have been trained on giving tours and that.
Perfect. So if you are eating there and you just ask, yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you guys all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.